It's another sort of cat they must throw in my face, and not that poor scurvy knave. Pincers and hammers, mallets and chisels would not get it out of my grip. No, nor lion's claws. The soul from my body first.
She is right, said the man. I own myself beaten and powerless. I confess I haven't the strength to take it from her.
And he let go his hold of her. Upon this the governor said to the woman, Let me see that purse, my worthy and sturdy friend. She handed it to him at once, and the governor returned it to the man, and said to the unforced mistress of force, Sister, if you had shown as much, or only half as much, spirit and vigour in defending your body as you have shown in defending that purse, the strength of Hercules could not have forced you. Be off, and God speed you, and bad luck to you, and don't show your face in all this island or within 6 leagues of it on any side under pain of 200 lashes. Be off at once, I say, you shameless, cheating shrew. The woman was cowed and went off disconsolately, hanging her head. And the governor said to the man, Honest man, go home with your money and God speed you. And for the future, if you don't want to lose it, see that you don't take it into your head to yoke with anybody. The man thanked him as clumsily as he could, and went his way, and the bystanders were again filled with admiration at their new governor's judgments and sentences. Next, 2 men, one apparently a farm labourer and the other a tailor, for he had a pair of shears in his hand, presented themselves before him, and the tailor said,
Senor Governor, this labourer and I come before your worship by reason of this honest man coming to my shop yesterday for saving everybody's presence, I'm a qualified tailor, God be thanked, and putting a piece of cloth into my hands and asking me, Senor, will there be enough in this cloth to make me a cap? Measuring the cloth, I said there would. He probably suspected, as I supposed, and I supposed right, that I wanted to steal some of the cloth, led to think so by his own roguery and the bad opinion people have of tailors. And he told me to see if there would be enough for 2. I guessed what he would be at, and I said yes. He, still following up his original unworthy notion, went on adding cap after cap, and I yes after yes, until we got as far as 5. He has just this moment come for them. I gave them to him, but he won't pay me for the making. On the contrary, he calls upon me to pay him, or else return his cloth.
"Is all this true, brother?" said Sancho.
"Yes," replied the man. "But will your worship make him show the 5 caps he has made me?"
"With all my heart," said the tailor.
And drawing his hand from under his cloak, he showed 5 caps stuck upon the 5 fingers of it, and said,
There are the caps this good man asks for, and by God and upon my conscience I haven't a scrap of cloth left, and I'll let the work be examined by the inspectors of the trade.
All present laughed at the number of caps and the novelty of the suit. Sancho set himself to think for a moment, and then said,
It seems to me that in this case it is not necessary to deliver long-winded arguments, but only to give offhand the judgment of an honest man. And so my decision is that the tailor lose the making and the labourer the cloth, and that the caps go to the prisoners in the jail, and let there be no more about it.
If the previous decision about the cattle dealer's purse excited the admiration of the bystanders, this provoked their laughter. However, the governor's orders were, after all, executed. All this, having been taken down by his chronicler, was at once dispatched to the duke, who was looking out for it with great eagerness. And here let us leave the good Sancho, for his master, sorely troubled in mind by Altisidora's music, has pressing claims upon us now. Chapter 46 Of the Terrible Bell and Cat Fright That Don Quixote Got in the Course of the Enamoured Altisidora's Wooing. We left Don Quixote wrapped up in the reflections which the music of the enamoured maid Altisidora had given rise to. He went to bed with them, and just like fleas they would not let him sleep or get a moment's rest, and the broken stitches of his stockings helped them. But as time is fleet and no obstacle can stay his course, he came riding on the hours, and morning very soon arrived. Seeing which, Don Quixote quitted the soft down, and, nowise slothful, dressed himself in his chamois suit, and put on his travelling boots, to hide the disaster of his stockings. He threw over him his scarlet mantle, put on his head a montera of green velvet trimmed with silver edging, flung across his shoulder the baldric with his good trenchant sword, took up a large rosary that he always carried with him, and with great solemnity and precision of gait, proceeded to the antechamber where the Duke and Duchess were already dressed and waiting for him. But as he passed through a gallery, Altisidora and the other damsel, her friend, were lying in wait for him, and the instant Altisidora saw him she pretended to faint, while her friend caught her in her lap and began hastily unlacing the bosom of her dress. Don Quixote observed it, and approaching them said, "I know very well what this seizure arises from."
"I know not from what," replied the friend, "for Altisidora is the healthiest damsel in all this house, and I have never heard her complain all the time I have known her. A plague on all the knights errant in this world, if they be all ungrateful. Go away, Señor Don Quixote, for this poor child will not come to herself again so long as you are here."
To which Don Quixote returned, "Do me the favour, Señora, to let a lute be placed in my chamber tonight, and I will comfort this poor maiden to the best of my power, for in the early stages of love a prompt disillusion is an approved remedy." And with this he retired, so as not to be remarked by any who might see him there. He had scarcely withdrawn when Altisidora, recovering from her swoon, said to her companion, "The lute must be left, for no doubt Don Quixote intends to give us some music, and being his, it will not be bad." They went at once to inform the Duchess of what was going on, and of the lute Don Quixote asked for, and she, delighted beyond measure, plotted with the Duke and her two damsels to play him a trick that should be amusing but harmless. And in high glee they waited for night, which came quickly as the day had come. And as for the day, the Duke and Duchess spent it in charming conversation with Don Quixote. When 11 o'clock came, Don Quixote found a guitar in his chamber. He tried it, opened the window, and perceived that some persons were walking in the garden, and having passed his fingers over the frets of the guitar and tuned it as well as he could, he spat and cleared his chest, and then with a voice a little hoarse but full-toned, he sang the following ballad, which he had himself that day composed. "Mighty love the hearts of maidens doth unsettle and perplex, and the instrument he uses most of all is idleness. Sewing, stitching, any labour, having always work to do, to the poison love instilleth, is the antidote most sure. And to proper-minded maidens who desire the matron's name, modesty's a marriage portion, modesty their highest praise. Men of prudence and discretion, courtiers gay and gallant knights, with the wanton damsels dally, but the modest take to wife. There are passions, transient, fleeting, loves in hostelries declared, sunrise loves with sunset ended, when the guest hath gone his way. Love that springs up swift and sudden, here today, tomorrow flown, passes, leaves no trace behind it, leaves no image on the soul. Painting that is laid on painting maketh no display or show. Where one beauty's in possession, there's no other can take hold. Dulcinea del Toboso, painted on my heart I wear. Never from its tablets, never can her image be erased. The quality of all in lovers most esteemed is constancy. 'Tis by this that love works wonders. This exalts them to the skies." Don Quixote had got so far with his song, to which the Duke, the Duchess, Altisidora, and nearly the whole household of the castle were listening, when all of a sudden, from a gallery above that was exactly over his window, they let down a cord with more than 100 bells attached to it, and immediately after that discharged a great sackful of cats, which also had bells of smaller size tied to their tails. Such was the din of the bells and the squalling of the cats that though the Duke and Duchess were the contrivers of the joke, they were startled by it, while Don Quixote stood paralyzed with fear. And as luck would have it, two or three of the cats made their way in through the grating of his chamber, and flying from one side to the other made it seem as if there was a legion of devils at large in it. They extinguished the candles that were burning in the room, and rushed about seeking some way of escape. The cord with the large bells never ceased rising and falling, and most of the people of the castle, not knowing what was really the matter, were at their wits' end with astonishment. Don Quixote sprang to his feet, and drawing his sword, began making passes at the grating, shouting out,
"Avaunt, malignant enchanters! Avaunt, ye witchcraft-working rabble! I am Don Quixote of La Mancha, against whom your evil machinations avail not, nor have any power."
And turning upon the cats that were running about the room, he made several cuts at them. They dashed at the grating and escaped by it, save one that, finding itself hard pressed by the slashes of Don Quixote's sword, flew at his face and held on to his nose, tooth and nail, with the pain of which he began to shout his loudest. The Duke and Duchess, hearing this and guessing what it was, ran with all haste to his room, and as the poor gentleman was striving with all his might to detach the cat from his face, They opened the door with a master key and went in with lights and witnessed the unequal combat. The Duke ran forward to part the combatants, but Don Quixote cried out aloud, "Let no one take him from me! Leave me hand to hand with this demon, this wizard, this enchanter! I will teach him, I myself, who Don Quixote of La Mancha is!" The cat, however, never minding these threats, snarled and held on. But at last the Duke pulled it off and flung it out of the window. Don Quixote was left with a face as full of holes as a sieve, and a nose not in very good condition, and greatly vexed that they did not let him finish the battle he had been so stoutly fighting with that villain of an enchanter. They sent for some oil of John's wort, and Altisidora herself with her own fair hands bandaged all the wounded parts. And as she did so she said to him in a low voice, "All these mishaps have befallen thee, hard-hearted knight, for the sin of thy insensibility and obstinacy, and God grant thy squire Sancho may forget to whip himself, so that dearly beloved Dulcinea of thine may never be released from her enchantment, that thou mayest never come to her bed, at least while I who adore thee am alive." To all this Don Quixote made no answer, except to heave deep sighs, and then stretched himself on his bed, thanking the Duke and Duchess for their kindness, not because he stood in any fear of that bell-ringing rabble of enchanters in cat shape, but because he recognized their good intentions in coming to his rescue. The Duke and Duchess left him to repose, and withdrew greatly grieved at the unfortunate result of the joke, as they had never thought the adventure would have fallen so heavy on Don Quixote, or cost him so dear, for it cost him 5 days of confinement to his bed, during which he had another adventure, pleasanter than the late one, which his chronicler will not relate just now, in order that he may turn his attention to Sancho Panza, who was proceeding with great diligence and drollery in his government. Chapter 47 Wherein is continued the account of how Sancho Panza conducted himself in his government. The history says that from the justice court they carried Sancho to a sumptuous palace, where in a spacious chamber there was a table laid out with royal magnificence. The clarion sounded as Sancho entered the room, and 4 pages came forward to present him with water for his hands, which Sancho received with great dignity. The music ceased, and Sancho seated himself at the head of the table, for there was only that seat placed, and no more than 1 cover laid. A personage, who, it appeared afterwards, was a physician, placed himself standing by his side with a whalebone wand in his hand. They then lifted up a fine white cloth covering fruit and a great variety of dishes of different sorts. One, who looked like a student, said grace, and a page put a laced bib on Sancho, while another, who played the part of head carver, placed a dish of fruit before him. But hardly had he tasted a morsel when the man with the wand touched the plate with it, and they took it away from before him with the utmost celerity. The carver, however, brought him another dish, and Sancho proceeded to try it. But before he could get at it, not to say taste it, already the wand had touched it, and a page had carried it off with the same promptitude as the fruit. Sancho, seeing this, was puzzled, and after looking from one to another, asked if this dinner was to be eaten after the fashion of a jugglery trick. To this he with the wand replied, "It is not to be eaten, Senor Governor, except as is usual and customary in other islands where there are governors. I, Senor, am a physician, and I am paid a salary in this island to serve its governors as such, and I have a much greater regard for their health than for my own, studying day and night and making myself acquainted with the governor's constitution, in order to be able to cure him when he falls sick. The chief thing I have to do is to attend at his dinners and suppers, and allow him to eat what appears to me to be fit for him, and to keep from him what I think will do him harm and be injurious to his stomach. And therefore I ordered that plate of fruit to be removed as being too moist, and that other dish I ordered to be removed for being too hot, and containing many spices that stimulate thirst. For he who drinks much kills and consumes the radical moisture wherein life consists." "Well then," said Sancho, "that dish of roast partridges there that seems so savory will not do me any harm." To this the physician replied, "Of those, my lord, the governor shall not eat so long as I live." "Why so?" said Sancho. "Because," replied the doctor, "our master Hippocrates, the pole star and beacon of medicine, says in one of his aphorisms, omnis saturatio mala, pedicis autem pessima, which means all repletion is bad, but that of partridge is the worst of all." "In that case," said Sancho, "let Senor Doctor see among the dishes that are on the table what will do me most good and least harm, and let me eat it without tapping it with his stick. For by the life of the governor, and so may God suffer me to enjoy it, but I'm dying of hunger, and in spite of the doctor and all he may say, to deny me food is the way to take my life instead of prolonging it.
"Your worship is right, Senor Governor," said the physician, "and therefore your worship, I consider, should not eat of those stewed rabbits there, because it is a furry kind of food. If that veal were not roasted and served with pickles, you might try it, but it is out of the question."
"That big dish that is smoking farther off," said Sancho, "seems to me to be an old meat stew, and out of the diversity of things in such stews I can't fail to light upon something tasty and good for me."
"Absit," said the doctor. "Far from us be any such base thought. There is nothing in the world less nourishing than an old meat stew. To canons or rectors of colleges or peasants' weddings with your old meat stews, but let us have none of them on the tables of governors, where everything that is present should be delicate and refined. And the reason is that always, everywhere, and by everybody, simple medicines are more esteemed than compound ones. For we cannot go wrong in those that are simple, while in the compound we may, by merely altering the quantity of the things composing them. But what I am of the opinion the governor should eat, now, in order to preserve and fortify his health, is 100 or so of wafer cakes, and a few thin slices of conserve of quinces, which will settle his stomach and help his digestion."
Sancho, on hearing this, threw himself back in his chair and surveyed the doctor steadily, and in a solemn tone asked him what his name was and where he had studied. He replied,
"My name, Señor Governor, is Dr. Pedro Recio de Agüero. I am a native of a place called Tirteafuera, which lies between Caracuel and Almodóvar del Campo, on the right-hand side, and I have the degree of doctor from the University of Osuna."
To which Sancho, glowing all over with rage, returned,
"Then let Dr. Pedro Recio de Malaguero, native of Tirteafuera, a place that's on the right-hand side as we go from Caracuel to Almodóvar del Campo, graduate of Osuna, get out of my presence at once, or I swear by the sun I'll take a cudgel, and by dint of blows, beginning with him, I'll not leave a doctor in the whole island, at least of those I know to be ignorant. For as to learned, wise, sensible physicians, them I will reverence and honour as divine persons. Once more I say, let Pedro Recio get out of this, or I'll take this chair I am sitting on and break it over his head, and if they call me to account for it, I'll clear myself by saying I served God in killing a bad doctor, a general executioner. And now, give me something to eat, or else take your government, for a trade that does not feed its master is not worth two beans."
The doctor was dismayed when he saw the governor in such a passion, and he would have fled from the room, but that the same instant a post-horn sounded in the street. And the carver, putting his head out of the window, turned round and said,
"It's a courier from my lord the Duke, no doubt with some dispatch of importance."
The courier came in all sweating and flurried, and taking a paper from his bosom placed it in the governor's hands. Sancho handed it to the majordomo and bade him read the superscription, which ran thus: "To Don Sancho Panza, governor of the island of Barataria, into his own hands or those of his secretary." Sancho, when he heard this, said,
"Which of you is my secretary?"
"I am, senor," said one of those present, "for I can read and write, and I'm a Biscayan."
"With that addition," said Sancho, "you might be secretary to the emperor himself. Open this paper and see what it says."
The newborn secretary obeyed, and having read the contents, said the matter was one to be discussed in private. Sancho ordered the chamber to be cleared, the majordomo and the carver only remaining. So the doctor and the others withdrew, and then the secretary read the letter, which was as follows:
"It has come to my knowledge, Senor Don Sancho Panza, that certain enemies of mine and of the island are about to make a furious attack upon it some night, I know not when. It behoves you to be on the alert and keep watch, that they surprise you not. I also know by trustworthy spies that 4 persons have entered the town in disguise in order to take your life, because they stand in dread of your great capacity. Keep your eyes open and take heed who approaches you to address you, and eat nothing that is presented to you. I will take care to send you aid if you find yourself in difficulty, but in all things you will act as may be expected of your judgment. From this place, the 16th of August at 4 in the morning, your friend, the Duke."
Sancho was astonished, and those who stood by made believe to be so too, and turning to the majordomo, he said to him,
"What we have got to do first, and it must be done at once, is to put Dr. Recio in the lock-up, for if anyone wants to kill me, it is he, and by a slow death and the worst of all, which is hunger.
Likewise, said the carver, it is my opinion your worship should not eat anything that is on this table, for the whole was a present from some nuns, and as they say, behind the cross there's the devil.
I don't deny it, said Sancho.
So for the present give me a piece of bread and 4 pounds or so of grapes. No poison can come in them, for the fact is I can't go on without eating, and if we are to be prepared for these battles that are threatening us, we must be well provisioned, for it is the belly that carries the heart, not the heart the belly. And you, secretary, answer my lord the duke and tell him that all his commands shall be obeyed to the letter as he directs. And say from me to my lady the duchess that I kiss her hands, and that I beg of her not to forget to send my letter and bundle to my wife Teresa Panza by a messenger, and I will take it as a great favour and will not fail to serve her in all that may lie within my power. And as you are about it, you may enclose a kiss of the hand to my master Don Quixote, that he may see I am neither forgetful nor ungrateful. And, as a good secretary and good Biscayan, you may add whatever you like and whatever will come in best. And now, take away this cloth, and give me something to eat, and I'll be ready to meet all the spies and assassins and enchanters that may come against me or my island. At this instant, a page entered, saying, Here's a farmer on business who wants to speak to your lordship on a matter of great importance, he says. It is very odd, said Sancho, the ways of these men on business. Is it possible they can be such fools as not to see that an hour like this is no hour for coming on business? We who govern and we who are judges, are we not men of flesh and blood, and are we not to be allowed the time required for taking rest, unless they'd have us made of marble? By God and on my conscience, if the government remains in my hands, which I have a notion it won't, I'll bring more than one man on business to order. Now, however, tell this good man to come in, but take care first of all that he is not some spy or one of my assassins.
No, my lord, said the page, for he looks like a simple fellow, and either I know very little, or he is as good as bread itself.
There is nothing to be afraid of, said the majordomo, for we are all here.
Would it be possible, carver, said Sancho, now that Dr. Pedro Recio is not here, to let me eat something solid and substantial, if it were even a piece of bread and an onion?
Tonight, at supper, said the carver, the shortcomings of the dinner shall be made good, and your lordship shall be fully contented.
God grant it, said Sancho.
The farmer now came in. A well-favoured man that one might see 1,000 leagues off was an honest fellow and a good soul. The first thing he said was,
Which is the Lord Governor here?
Which should it be, said the secretary, but he who is seated in the chair?
Then I humble myself before him, said the farmer.
And going on his knees, he asked for his hand to kiss it. Sancho refused it, and bade him stand up and say what he wanted. The farmer obeyed, and then said,
I am a farmer, senor, a native of Miguelturra, a village 2 leagues from Ciudad Real.
Another tierte afuera, said Sancho. Say on, brother, I know Miguelturra very well, I can tell you, for it's not very far from my own town.
The case is this, senor, continued the farmer, by God's mercy I am married with the leave and license of the Holy Roman Catholic Church. I have 2 sons, students, and the younger is studying to become bachelor and the elder to be master of arts. I am a widower, for my wife died, or more properly speaking, a bad doctor killed her on my hands, giving her a purge when she was with child. And if it had pleased God that the child had been born and was a boy, I would have put him to study for doctor, that he might not envy his brothers, the bachelor and the master.
So that if your wife had not died or had not been killed, you would not now be a widower, said Sancho.
No, senor, certainly not, said the farmer.
We've got that much settled, said Sancho. Get on, brother, for it's more bedtime than business time.
Well, then, said the farmer, this son of mine who is going to be a bachelor fell in love in the said town with a damsel called Clara Pellerina, daughter of Andres Pellerino, a very rich farmer. And this name of Pellerines does not come to them by ancestry or descent, but because all the family have the palsy, and for a better name they call them Pellerines. Though, to tell the truth, the damsel is as fair as an oriental pearl, and like a flower of the field if you look at her on the right side. On the left, not so much, for on that side she wants an eye that she lost by smallpox. And though her face is thickly and deeply pitted, those who love her say they are not pits that are there, but the graves where the hearts of her lovers are buried. She is so cleanly that, not to soil her face, she carries her nose turned up, as they say, so that one would fancy it was running away from her mouth. And with all this, she looks extremely well, for she has a wide mouth, and but for wanting 10 or a dozen teeth, she might compare and compete with the comeliest. Of her lips I say nothing, for they are so fine and thin that if lips might be reeled, one might make a skein of them.
but being of a different colour from ordinary lips, they are wonderful, for they are mottled, blue, green, and purple. Let my lord the governor pardon me for painting so minutely the charms of her who, some time or other, will be my daughter, for I love her, and I don't find her amiss.
"Paint what you will," said Sancho. "I enjoy your painting, and if I had dined there could be no dessert more to my taste than your portrait."
"That I have still to furnish," said the farmer, "but a time will come when we may be able, if we are not now. And I could tell you, senor, if I could paint her gracefulness and her tall figure, it would astonish you. But that is impossible, because she's bent double with her knees up to her mouth. But for all that, it is easy to see that if she could stand up, she'd knock her head against the ceiling. And she would have given her hand to my bachelor ere this, only that she can't stretch it out, for it's contracted. But still, one can see its elegance and fine make by its long furrowed nails."
"That will do, brother," said Sancho. "Consider you have painted her from head to foot. What is it you want now? Come to the point without all this beating about the bush and all these scraps and additions."
I want your worship, senor," said the farmer, "to do me the favour of giving me a letter of recommendation to the girl's father, begging him to be so good as to let this marriage take place, as we are not ill-matched either in the gifts of fortune or of nature. For to tell the truth, Signor Governor, my son is possessed of a devil, and there is not a day but the evil spirits torment him 3 or 4 times. And from having once fallen into the fire, he has his face puckered up like a piece of parchment, and his eyes watery and always running. But he has the disposition of an angel, and if it was not for belabouring and pummeling himself, he'd be a saint."
"Is there anything else you want, good man?" said Sancho.
"There's another thing I'd like," said the farmer, "but I'm afraid to mention it. However, out it must. For after all, I can't let it be rotting in my breast, come what may. I mean, senor, that I'd like your worship to give me 300 or 600 ducats as a help to my bachelor's portion, to help him in setting up a house. For they must, in short, live by themselves without being subject to the interferences of their fathers-in-law."
"Just see if there's anything else you'd like," said Sancho, "and don't hold back from mentioning it out of bashfulness or modesty."
No, indeed, there is not," said the farmer.
The moment he had said this, the governor started to his feet, and seizing the chair he had been sitting on, exclaimed,
"By all that's good, you ill-bred, boorish Don Bumpkin, if you don't get out of this at once, and hide yourself from my sight, I'll lay your head open with this chair. You whoreson and rascal, you devil's own painter! And is it at this hour you come to ask me for 600 ducats? How should I have them, you stinking brute? And why should I give them to you if I had them, you knave and blockhead? What have I to do with Miguel Tura or the whole family of the Pelerines? Get out, I say, or by the life of my lord the Duke, I'll do as I said. You're not from Miguel Tura, but some knave sent here from hell to tempt me. Why, you villain, I have not yet had the government half a day, and you want me to have 600 ducats already?"
The carver made signs to the farmer to leave the room, which he did with his head down, and to all appearance in terror lest the governor should carry his threats into effect, for the rogue knew very well how to play his part. But let us leave Sancho in his wrath, and peace be with them all, and let us return to Don Quixote, whom we left with his face bandaged and doctored after the cat wounds, of which he was not cured for 8 days. And on one of these there befell him what Cide Hamete promises to relate with that exactitude and truth with which he is wont to set forth everything connected with this great history, however minute it might be. Chapter 48. Of what befell Don Quixote with Doña Rodriguez, the Duchess's duenna, together with other occurrences worthy of record and eternal remembrance. Exceedingly moody and dejected was the sorely wounded Don Quixote, with his face bandaged and marked, not by the hand of God, but by the claws of a cat, mishaps incidental to knight-errantry. 6 days he remained without appearing in public, and one night as he lay awake thinking of his misfortunes and of Altisidora's pursuit of him, he perceived that someone was opening the door of his room with a key, and he at once made up his mind that the enamoured damsel was coming to make an assault upon his chastity, and put him in danger of failing in the fidelity he owed to his lady Dulcinea del Toboso. "No," said he, firmly persuaded of the truth of his idea, and he said it loud enough to be heard, "the greatest beauty upon earth shall not avail to make me renounce my adoration of her whom I bear stamped and graved in the core of my heart and the secret depths of my bowels.
Be thou, lady mine, transformed into a clumsy country wench, or into a nymph of golden Tagus weaving a web of silk and gold. Let Merlin or Montesinos hold thee captive where they will. Where'er thou art mine, and where'er I am, must be thine.
The very instant he had uttered these words, the door opened. He stood up on the bed, wrapped from head to foot in a yellow satin coverlet, with a cap on his head, and his face and his moustaches tied up, his face because of the scratches, and his moustaches to keep them from drooping and falling down, in which trim he looked the most extraordinary scarecrow that could be conceived. He kept his eyes fixed on the door, and just as he was expecting to see the love-smitten and unhappy Altisidora make her appearance, he saw coming in a most venerable duenna, in a long white-bordered veil that covered and enveloped her from head to foot. Between the fingers of her left hand she held a short lighted candle, while with her right she shaded it to keep the light from her eyes, which were covered by spectacles of great size, and she advanced with noiseless steps, treading very softly. Don Quixote kept an eye upon her from his watch-tower, and observing her costume and noting her silence, he concluded that it must be some witch or sorceress that was coming in such a guise to work him some mischief, and he began crossing himself at a great rate. The spectre still advanced, and on reaching the middle of the room, looked up and saw the energy with which Don Quixote was crossing himself. And if he was scared by seeing such a figure as hers, she was terrified at the sight of his. For the moment she saw his tall yellow form with the coverlet and the bandages that disfigured him, she gave a loud scream, and exclaiming, "Jesus, what's this I see?" let fall the candle in her fright, and then, finding herself in the dark, turned about to make off, but stumbling on her skirts in her consternation, she measured her length with a mighty fall. Don Quixote, in his trepidation, began saying, "I conjure thee, phantom, or whatever thou art, tell me what thou art and what thou wouldst with me. If thou art a soul in torment, say so, and all that my powers can do I will do for thee, for I am a Catholic Christian and love to do good to all the world, and to this end I have embraced the order of knight-errantry to which I belong, the province of which extends to doing good even to souls in purgatory." The unfortunate duenna, hearing herself thus conjured, by her own fear, guessed Don Quixote's, and in a low, plaintive voice answered, "Señor Don Quixote, if so be you are indeed Don Quixote, I am no phantom or spectre or soul in purgatory, as you seem to think, but Doña Rodriguez, duenna of honour to my lady the Duchess, and I come to you with one of those grievances your worship is wont to redress."
"Tell me, Señora Doña Rodriguez," said Don Quixote, "do you perchance come to transact any go-between business? Because I must tell you I am not available for anybody's purpose, thanks to the peerless beauty of my lady Dulcinea del Toboso. In short, Señora Doña Rodriguez, if you will leave out and put aside all love-messages, you may go and light your candle and come back, and we will discuss all the commands you have for me and whatever you wish, saving only, as I said, all seductive communications."
"I carry nobody's messages, señor," said the duenna. "Little you know me. Nay, I'm not far enough advanced in years to take to any such childish tricks. God be praised, I have a soul in my body still, and all my teeth in my mouth, except one or two that the cold, so common in this Aragon country, have robbed me of. But wait a little while I go and light my candle, and I will return immediately and lay my sorrows before you, as before one who relieves those of all the world."
And without staying for an answer, she quitted the room and left Don Quixote tranquilly meditating while he waited for her. A thousand thoughts at once suggested themselves to him on the subject of this new adventure, and it struck him as being ill done and worse advised in him to expose himself to the danger of breaking his plighted faith to his lady. And said he to himself, "Who knows but that the devil, being wily and cunning, may be trying now to entrap me with a duenna, having failed with empresses, queens, duchesses, marchionesses, and countesses. Many a time have I heard it said by many a man of sense that he will sooner offer you a flat-nosed wench than a Roman-nosed one. And who knows but this privacy, this opportunity, this silence may awaken my sleeping desires, and lead me in these my latter years to fall where I have never tripped. In cases of this sort, it is better to flee than to await the battle. But I must be out of my senses to think and utter such nonsense, for it is impossible that a long, white-hooded, spectacled duenna could stir up or excite a wanton thought in the most graceless bosom in the world. Is there a duenna on earth that has fair flesh?
Is there a duenna in the world that escapes being ill-tempered, wrinkled, and prudish? Avaunt, then, ye duenna crew, undelightful to all mankind. Oh, but that lady did well, who, as they say, had at the end of her reception room a couple of figures of duennas with spectacles and lace cushions, as if at work, and those statues served quite as well to give an air of propriety to the room as if they had been real duennas.
So saying, he leaped off the bed, intending to close the door and not allow Señora Rodríguez to enter. But as he went to shut it, Señora Rodríguez returned with a wax candle lighted, and having a closer view of Don Quixote, with the coverlet round him and his bandages and nightcap, she was alarmed afresh, and retreating a couple of paces exclaimed,
"Am I safe, Sir Knight? For I don't look upon it as a sign of very great virtue that your worship should have got up out of bed."
"I may well ask the same, Señora," said Don Quixote. "And I do ask whether I shall be safe from being assailed and forced."
"Of whom and against whom do you demand that security, Sir Knight?" said the duenna.
"Of you and against you, I ask it," said Don Quixote. "For I am not marble, nor are you brass, nor is it now 10 o'clock in the morning, but midnight, or a trifle past it, I fancy, and we are in a room more secluded and retiring than the cave could have been where the treacherous and daring Aeneas enjoyed the fair, soft-hearted Dido. But give me your hand, Señora. I require no better protection than my own continence and my own sense of propriety, as well as that which is inspired by that venerable headdress."
And so saying, he kissed her right hand and took it in his own, she yielding it to him with equal ceremoniousness. And here Cide Hamete inserts a parenthesis, in which he says that to have seen the pair marching from the door to the bed, linked hand in hand in this way, he would have given the best of the two tunics he had. Don Quixote finally got into bed, and Doña Rodríguez took her seat on a chair at some little distance from his couch, without taking off her spectacles or putting aside the candle. Don Quixote wrapped the bedclothes round him and covered himself up completely, leaving nothing but his face visible, and as soon as they had both regained their composure, he broke silence, saying,
"Now, Señora Doña Rodríguez, you may unbosom yourself and out with everything you have in your sorrowful heart and afflicted bowels. And by me you shall be listened to with chaste ears and aided by compassionate exertions."
"I believe it," replied the duenna. "From your worship's gentle and winning presence only such a Christian answer could be expected. The fact is, then, Señor Don Quixote, that though you see me seated in this chair here in the middle of the kingdom of Aragon, and in the attire of a despised outcast duenna, I am from the Asturias of Oviedo, and of a family with which many of the best of the province are connected by blood. But my untoward fate and the improvidence of my parents, who, I know not how, were unseasonably reduced to poverty, brought me to the court of Madrid, where, as a provision and to avoid greater misfortunes, my parents placed me as sempstress in the service of a lady of quality. And I would have you know that for hemming and sewing I have never been surpassed by any all my life. My parents left me in service and returned to their own country, and a few years later went, no doubt, to heaven, for they were excellent good Catholic Christians. I was left an orphan with nothing but the miserable wages and trifling presents that are given to servants of my sort in palaces. But about this time, without any encouragement on my part, one of the esquires of the household fell in love with me, a man somewhat advanced in years, full-bearded and personable, and above all as good a gentleman as the king himself, for he came of a mountain stock. We did not carry on our loves with such secrecy but that they came to the knowledge of my lady, and she, not to have any fuss about it, had us married with the full sanction of the Holy Mother Roman Catholic Church, of which marriage a daughter was born to put an end to my good fortune, if I had any. Not that I died in childbirth, for I passed through it safely and in due season, but because shortly afterwards my husband died of a certain shock he received, and had I the time to tell you of it, I know your worship would be surprised."
And here she began to weep bitterly, and said,
"Pardon me, Don Quixote, if I am unable to control myself, for every time I think of my unfortunate husband my eyes fill up with tears. God bless me! With what an air of dignity he used to carry my lady behind him on a stout mule as black as jet! For in those days they did not use coaches or chairs as they say they do now, and ladies rode behind their squires. But this much at least I cannot help telling you, that
you may observe the good breeding and punctiliousness of my worthy husband. As he was turning into the Calle de Santiago in Madrid, which is rather narrow, one of the judges of the court, with two officers before him, was coming out of it. And as soon as my good squire saw him, he wheeled his mule about and made as if he would turn and accompany him. My lady, who was riding behind him, said to him in a low voice, "What are you about, you sneak? Don't you see that I am here?" The judge, like a polite man, pulled up his horse and said to him, "Proceed, senor, for it is I, rather, who ought to accompany my lady, Doña Casilda," for that was my mistress's name. Still, my husband, cap in hand, persisted in trying to accompany the judge, and seeing this, my lady, filled with rage and vexation, pulled out a big pin, or I rather think a bodkin, out of her needle-case, and drove it into his back with such force that my husband gave a loud yell and, writhing, fell to the ground with his lady. Her two lackeys ran to rise her up, and the judge and the officers did the same. The Guadalajara gate was all in commotion. I mean, the idlers congregated there. My mistress came back on foot, and my husband hurried away to a surgeon, protesting that he was run right through the guts. The courtesy of my husband was noised abroad to such an extent that the boys teased him and gave him no peace in the street, and on this account, and because he was somewhat short-sighted, my lady dismissed him. And it was chagrin at this, I am convinced beyond a doubt, that brought on his death. I was left a helpless widow, with a daughter on my hands growing up in beauty like the sea-foam. At length, however, as I had the character of being an excellent needlewoman, my lady the Duchess, then lately married to my lord the Duke, offered to take me with her to this kingdom of Aragon, and my daughter also. And here, as time went by, my daughter grew up, and with her all the graces of the world. She sings like a lark, dances quick as thought, foots it like a gypsy, reads and writes like a schoolmaster, and does sums like a miser. Of her neatness I say nothing, for the running water is not purer, and her age is now, if my memory serves me, 16 years, 5 months and 3 days, one more or less. To come to the point, the son of a very rich farmer living in a village of my lord the Duke's not very far from here fell in love with this girl of mine, and in short, how, I know not, they came together, and under the promise of marrying her he made a fool of my daughter, and will not keep his word. And though my lord the Duke is aware of it, for I have complained to him not once but many and many a time, and entreated him to order the farmer to marry my daughter, he turns a deaf ear and will scarcely listen to me. The reason being that as the deceiver's father is so rich and lends him money and is constantly going security for his debts, he does not like to offend or annoy him in any way. Now, senor, I want your worship to take it upon yourself to redress this wrong, either by entreaty or by arms. For by what all the world says, you came into it to redress grievances and right wrongs and help the unfortunate. Let your worship put before you the unprotected condition of my daughter, her youth and all the perfections I have said she possesses. And before God and on my conscience, out of all the damsels my lady has, there is not one that comes up to the sole of her shoe, and the one they call Altisidora, and look upon as the boldest and gayest of them, put in comparison with my daughter, does not come within 2 leagues of her. For I would have you know, senor, all is not gold that glitters, and that same little Altisidora has more forwardness than good looks, and more impudence than modesty. Besides not being very sound, for she has such a disagreeable breath that one cannot bear to be near her for a moment. And even my lady the Duchess, but I'll hold my tongue, for they say that walls have ears. For heaven's sake, Doña Rodriguez, what ails my lady the Duchess? Asked Don Quixote. Adjured in that way, replied the duenna, I cannot help answering the question, and telling the whole truth. Señor Don Quixote, have you observed the comeliness of my lady the Duchess, that smooth complexion of hers, like a burnished, polished sword? Those 2 cheeks of milk and carmine, that gay, lively step with which she treads, or rather seems to spurn the earth, so that one would fancy she went radiating health wherever she passed? Well, then, let me tell you, she may thank first of all God for this, and next 2 issues that she has, one in each leg, by which all the evil humours of which the doctors say she is full are discharged. Blessed Virgin! Exclaimed Don Quixote. And is it possible that my lady the Duchess has drains of that sort? I would not have believed it if the barefoot friars had told it me.
But as the Lady Doña Rodriguez says so, it must be so.
But surely such issues and in such places do not discharge humours, but liquid amber.
Verily, I do believe now that this place of opening issues is a very important matter for the health.
Don Quixote had hardly said this when the chamber door flew open with a loud bang, and with the start the noise gave her, Doña Rodriguez let the candle fall from her hand, and the room was left as dark as a wolf's mouth, as the saying is. Suddenly the poor duenna felt two hands seize her by the throat so tightly that she could not croak, while someone else, without uttering a word, very briskly hoisted up her petticoats, and with what seemed to be a slipper, began to lay on so heartily that anyone would have felt pity for her. But although Don Quixote felt it, he never stirred from his bed, but lay quiet and silent, nay, apprehensive that his turn for a drubbing might be coming. Nor was the apprehension an idle one, for, leaving the duenna, who did not dare to cry out, well basted, the silent executioners fell upon Don Quixote, and stripping him of the sheet and the coverlet, they pinched him so fast and so hard that he was driven to defend himself with his fists, and all this in marvellous silence. The battle lasted nearly half an hour, and then the phantoms fled. Doña Rodriguez gathered up her skirts, and bemoaning her fate, went out without saying a word to Don Quixote, and he, sorely pinched, puzzled and dejected, remained alone. And there we will leave him, wondering who could have been the perverse enchanter who had reduced him to such a state. But that shall be told in due season, for Sancho claims our attention, and the methodical arrangement of the story demands it. Chapter 49 Of What Happened to Sancho in Making the Round of His Island. We left the great governor angered and irritated by that portrait-painting rogue of a farmer who, instructed by the majordomo, as the majordomo was by the duke, tried to practice upon him. He, however, fool, boor, and clown as he was, held his own against them all, saying to those round him, and to Dr. Pedro Recio, who, as soon as the private business of the duke's letter was disposed of, had returned to the room, "Now I see plainly enough that judges and governors ought to be and must be made of brass not to feel the importunities of the applicants that at all times and all seasons insist on being heard, and having their business dispatched and their own affairs and no others attended to, come what may. And if the poor judge does not hear them and settle the matter, either because he cannot or because that is not the time set apart for hearing them, forthwith they abuse him and run him down and gnaw at his bones and even pick holes in his pedigree. You silly, stupid applicant, don't be in a hurry. Wait for the proper time and season for doing business. Don't come at dinner hour or at bedtime, for judges are only flesh and blood, and must give to nature what she naturally demands of them. All except myself, for in my case I give her nothing to eat, thanks to Señor Dr. Pedro Recio Tirtafuera here, who would have me die of hunger and declares that death to be life. And the same sort of life may God give him and all his kind, I mean the bad doctors, for the good ones deserve palms and laurels. All who knew Sancho Panza were astonished to hear him speak so elegantly, and did not know what to attribute it to, unless it were that office and grave responsibility either smarten or stupefy men's wits. At last Dr. Pedro Recio Agüero of Tirteafuera promised to let him have supper that night, though it might be in contravention of all the aphorisms of Hippocrates. With this the governor was satisfied and looked forward to the approach of night and supper-time with great anxiety. And though time to his mind stood still and made no progress, nevertheless the hour he so longed for came, and they gave him a beef salad with onions and some boiled calves' feet rather far gone. At this he fell to with greater relish than if they had given him francolins from Milan, pheasants from Rome, veal from Sorrento, partridges from Moron, or geese from Lavajos. And turning to the doctor at supper, he said to him, "Look here, Señor Doctor, for the future, don't trouble yourself about giving me dainty things or choice dishes to eat, for it will be only taking my stomach off its hinges. It is accustomed to goat, cow, bacon, hung beef, turnip, and onions. And if by any chance it is given these palace dishes, it receives them squeamishly and sometimes with loathing. What the head carver had best do is to serve me with what they call well-hung meat stews, and the rottener the meat is, the better they smell. And he can put whatever he likes into them, so long as it is good to eat, and I'll be obliged to him, and will requite him some day. But let nobody play pranks on me, for either we are or we are not. Let us live and eat in peace and good fellowship, for when God sends the dawn, he sends it for all.
I mean to govern this island without giving up a right or taking a bribe. Let everyone keep his eye open and look out for the arrow, for I can tell them the devil's in Cantiliana, and if they drive me to it, they'll see something that will astonish them. Nay, make yourself honey, and the flies eat you.
Of a truth, Senor Governor, said the carver, your worship is in the right of it in everything you have said, and I promise you in the name of all the inhabitants of this island that they will serve your worship with all zeal, affection, and goodwill, for the mild kind of government you have given a sample of to begin with leaves them no ground for doing or thinking anything to your worship's disadvantage.
That I believe, said Sancho, and they would be great fools if they did or thought otherwise. Once more I say, see to my feeding and my dapples, for that is the great point, and what is most to the purpose. And when the hour comes, let us go the rounds, for it is my intention to purge this island of all manner of uncleanness, and of all idle, good-for-nothing vagabonds. For I would have you know that lazy idlers are the same thing in a state as the drones in a hive, that eat up the honey the industrious bees make. I mean to protect the husbandman, to preserve to the gentleman his privileges, to reward the virtuous, and above all to respect religion and honour its ministers. What say you to that, my friends? Is there anything in what I say, or am I talking to no purpose?
There is so much in what your worship says, Senor Governor, said the majordomo, that I am filled with wonder when I see a man like your worship, entirely without learning, for I believe you have none at all, say such things, and so full of sound maxims and sage remarks. Very different from what was expected of your worship's intelligence by those who sent to us, or by us who came here. Every day we see something new in this world. Jokes become realities, and the jokers find the tables turned upon them.
Night came, and with the permission of Dr. Pedro Recio, the governor had supper. Then they got ready to go the rounds, and he started with the majordomo, the secretary, the head carver, the chronicler charged with recording his deeds, and officers and notaries enough to form a fair-sized squadron. In the midst marched Sancho with his staff, as fine a sight as one could wish to see, and but a few streets of the town had been traversed, when they heard a noise of a clashing of swords. They hastened to the spot, and found that the combatants were but two, who, seeing the authorities approaching, stood still, and one of them exclaimed,
"Help! In the name of God and the King! Are men to be allowed to rob in the middle of this town and rush out and attack people in the very streets?"
"Be calm, my good man," said Sancho, "and tell me what the cause of this quarrel is, for I am the governor." Said the other combatant, "Senor Governor, I will tell you in a very few words. Your worship must know that this gentleman has just now won more than 1,000 reals in that gambling-house opposite, and God knows how. I was there and gave more than one doubtful point in his favour, very much against what my conscience told me. He made off with his winnings, and when I made sure he was going to give me a crown or so at least by way of a tip, as is usual and customary to give men of quality of my sort who stand by to see fair or foul play and be at their back and prevent quarrels, he pocketed his money and left the house. Indignant at this, I followed him, and speaking him fairly and civilly, asked him to give me if it were only 8 reals, for he knows I am an honest man, and that I have neither profession nor property, for my parents never brought me up to any or left me any. But the rogue, who is a greater thief than Cacus and a greater sharper than Andradilla, would not give me more than 4 reals. So your worship may see how little shame and conscience he has. But by my faith, if you had not come up, I'd have made him disgorge his winnings, and he'd have learned what the range of the steelyard was.
What say you to this? Asked Sancho.
The other replied that all his antagonist said was true, and that he did not choose to give him more than 4 reals, because he very often gave him money, and that those who expected presents ought to be civil and take what is given them with a cheerful countenance, and not to make any claim against winners unless they know them for certain to be sharpers and their winnings to be unfairly won. And that there could be no better proof that he himself was an honest man than his having refused to give anything, for sharpers always pay tribute to lookers-on who know them.
"This is true," said the majordomo. "Let your worship consider what is to be done with these men."
"What is to be done," said Sancho, "is this. You, the winner, be you good, bad, or indifferent, give this assailant of yours 100 reals at once, and you must disperse 30 more for the poor prisoners. And you, who have neither profession nor property, and hang about the island in idleness, take these 100 reals now, and some time of the day tomorrow, quit the island under sentence of banishment for 10 years, and under pain of completing it in another life if you violate the sentence, for I'll hang you on a gibbet, or at least the hangman will, by my orders. Not a word from either of you, or I'll make him feel my hand."
This one paid down the money, and the other took it, and the latter quitted the island, while the other went home. And then the governor said, Either I am not good for much, or I'll get rid of these gambling houses, for it strikes me they are very mischievous.
This one, at least, said one of the notaries, your worship will not be able to get rid of, for a great man owns it, and what he loses every year is beyond all comparison more than what he makes by the cards. On the minor gambling houses your worship may exercise your power, and it is they that do most harm and shelter the most barefaced practices. For in the houses of lords and gentlemen of quality, the notorious sharpers dare not attempt to play their tricks, and as the vice of gambling has become common, it is better that men should play in houses of repute than in some tradesmen's, where they catch an unlucky fellow in the small hours of the morning and skin him alive.
"I know already, notary, that there is a good deal to be said on that point," said Sancho. And now a tipstaff came up with a young man in his grasp and said,
"Señor Governor, this youth was coming towards us, and as soon as he saw the officers of justice, he turned about and ran like a deer, as sure proof that he must be some evil-doer. I ran after him, and had it not been that he stumbled and fell, I should never have caught him."
"What did you run for, fellow?" said Sancho. To which the young man replied, "Señor, it was to avoid answering all the questions officers of justice put. What are you by trade?"
"A weaver."
"And what do you weave?"
"Steel heads for lances, with your worship's good leave."
"You're facetious with me. You plume yourself on being a wag."
"Very good. And where were you going just now?"
"To take the air, señor."
"And where does one take the air in this island?"
"Where it blows."
"Good. Your answers are very much to the point. You are a smart youth, but take notice that I am the air, and that I blow upon you astern and send you to jail. Ho there! Lay hold of him and take him off. I'll make him sleep there tonight without air."
"By God," said the young man, "your worship will make me sleep in jail just as soon as make me king."
"Why shan't I make thee sleep in jail?" said Sancho. "Have I not the power to arrest thee and release thee whenever I like?"
"All the power your worship has," says the young man, "won't be able to make me sleep in jail."
"How? Not able?" said Sancho. "Take him away at once, where he'll see his mistake with his own eyes, even if the jailer is willing to exert his interested generosity on his behalf. For I'll lay a penalty of 2,000 ducats on him if he allows him to stir a step from the prison."
"That's ridiculous," said the young man. "The fact is, all the men on earth will not make me sleep in prison."
"Tell me, you devil," said Sancho, "have you got any angel that will deliver you and take off the irons I'm going to order them to put on you?"
"Now, Señor Governor," said the young man in a sprightly manner, "let us be reasonable and come to the point. Granted, your worship may order me to be taken to prison, and to have irons and chains put on me, and to be shut up in a cell, and may lay heavy penalties on the jailer if he lets me out, and that he obeys your orders. Still, if I don't choose to sleep, and choose to remain awake all night without closing an eye, will your worship, with all your power, be able to make me sleep if I don't choose?"
"No, truly," said the secretary, "and the fellow has made his point."
"So then," said Sancho, "it would be entirely of your own choice you would keep from sleeping, not in opposition to my will."
"No, señor," said the youth, "certainly not."
"Well then, go, and God be with you," said Sancho. "Be off home to sleep, and God give you sound sleep, for I don't want to rob you of it. But for the future, let me advise you, don't joke with the authorities, because you may come across someone who will bring down the joke on your own skull." The young man went his way, and the governor continued his round, and shortly afterwards two tipstaffs came up with a man in custody and said,
"Señor Governor, this person who seems to be a man is not so, but a woman, and not an ill-favoured one, in man's clothes."
They raised two or three lanterns to her face, and by their light they distinguished the features of a woman to all appearance of the age of 16 or a little more, with her hair gathered into a golden-green silk net, and fair as a thousand pearls. They scanned her from head to foot, and observed that she had on red silk stockings with garters of white taffeta, bordered with gold and pearl. Her breeches were of green and gold stuff, and under an open jacket or jerkin of the same, she wore a doublet of the finest white and gold cloth. Her shoes were white, and such as men wear. She carried no sword at her belt, but only a richly ornamented dagger, and on her fingers she had several handsome rings. In short, the girl seemed fair to look at in the eyes of all, and none of those who beheld her knew her. The people of the town said they could not imagine who she was, and those who were in the secret of the jokes that were to be practised upon Sancho were the ones who were most surprised, for this incident or discovery had not been arranged by them, and they watched anxiously to see how the affair would end. Sancho was fascinated by the girl's beauty, and he asked her who she was, where she was going, and what had induced her to dress herself in that garb. She, with her eyes fixed on the ground, answered in modest confusion,
"I cannot tell you, Signor, before so many people, what it is of such consequence to me to have kept secret. One thing I wish to be known, that I am no thief or evildoer, but only an unhappy maiden whom the power of jealousy has led to break through the respect that is due to modesty."